beginning of the parsha, we have the rest of the three makos of Arba, Choshech, and Makos Bechoros. When Moshe Rabbeinu comes to tell Paro about Makos Bechoros, and this is really the final meeting between Paro and Moshe Rabbeinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a nevuah to Moshe Rabbeinu, and he says to him, Hashem said to Moshe, one more plague shall I bring upon Paro and upon Egypt. After that he shall send you forth from here. When he sends forth, it shall be complete. He shall drive you out of here. And then he adds something that we've seen already by the Sneh and Parshat Shemot. Daber na, please speak in the ears of the people. Let each man request of his fellow, and each woman from her fellow, silver vessels and gold vessels. Hashem granted the people favor in the eyes of Egypt. Moreover, the man Moshe was very great in the land of Egypt, the eyes of the servants of Paro and the eyes of his people, of the people. When we're talking about Daber Na, the word Na, please. So Rashi tells us it was a special effort to prevail upon the Jews to request valuables from the Egyptian neighbors, because unless they did so, the soul of Avram would have a grievance against Hashem. He would say, Hashem, you brought on the affliction and all the difficult hardships, but you didn't bring on the promise that they would leave with great wealth. Now, obviously, this end of this medrash of what it means, the promise of Avraham Avinu, that is a shirin of its own right. I want to just focus in on this idea of prevailing upon Klal Yisrael that they should be able to give. The commentators, this is sort of number three, are perplexed by this divine command. Hashem represents the ultimate truth, Emes. How could he direct Yisrael, let each man request of his fellow and each woman from her fellow, when they had no intentions of returning the silver and the gold vessels? So question number one, we'll have a number of questions. Question number one is, Hashem says, I want you to make a special effort to ask from these things. Question number one is, how could they possibly ask for these things when they had zero intention? Vayishalu, from the word lish'ol, to ask, to borrow. When they had zero intention of returning them, that's not honest, that's not, you know, upright. How could Klal Yisrael do this? Question number two. In making this request, let each man request of his fellow. The Hebrew word is re'ehu. It seems strange that the Egyptians here are called their fellows, when in fact, generally, we don't look at the non-Jewish world as a fellowship. Like, there's a distinction between Jews and non-Jews. So how do we understand here that Moshe Rabbeinu is being told that the Jews ask from the Egyptians who are their fellows? Just say, ask from the Egyptians. Why are they called Re'ehu here? Why are they called their friends? Third question. The Chasam Sofer asks, we see here, Daber Nabas Ne'am, Hainu Shayat Tzorich Larot Levnei Yisrael Shikum HaMitzri. By telling the people, please tell the Jews, I don't want to have Avram Avinu's promise not fulfilled. Please beg them to take the money. Now, if someone would come to me and say, Shira, I have loads of money to give you, would they need to beg me to take the money? Like, okay, where's the money? Here I am, ready to take it. It's almost as if it seems from the pshat of there has to be a convincing, Daber na, please, I'm begging you, can you please ask them to take the money? Why is it that Klal Yisrael wouldn't want to take the money? Why was it necessary to beg them to take the money? And further, how does this reconcile, says the Chasam Sofer, with further on in Parashat B'Shalach? Moshe Rabbeinu has to force the people to leave Kriyas Yamsuf because of all the Biza Sayam, of all the spoils at the sea. So by the spoils of the sea, they're, you know, taking as much as they can. Here, Moshe Rabbeinu has to plead with them, please take. Why is it here they didn't want to take, but by the spoils by the sea, they had no problem taking? And obviously, our final question is, what do we learn from this for our lives? What's the message in the fact that Hashem just didn't have them give it to them? Why they had to ask for it? What was the idea of borrowing without returning? What's the idea of the fellowship? And what's the idea of having to implore them to take that they really didn't want to take? We'll say at the outset, as we've said almost by every Shir, or we should say, there's a tremendous amount of understanding here. The challenge in this parsha, usually it's a challenge of finding material. This week, there was so much, it was about just trying to hone in on certain key ideas that we can integrate within our lives. I'd like to take a look at this at three levels. And the three distinctions are going to be the borrowing was kivyachol klape shmaya for Hashem's sake. The borrowing had to do, the focus wasn't Hashem, had to do with the Egyptians. And the third aspect, the borrowing had to do with the Jews. And those are going to be the three distinctions and the three levels of Mirtz Hashem are going to see. Why didn't the Jews want to borrow the money? So we spoke about this idea a few years ago in a Pesach Shir, source number 6. Umevaer haran shatachlip hazeh haya kriyas yam sof, shezeh aviyam lakara shavayaminu b'Hashem v'moshe avdo. V'chol zeh kara yidei shelo mitzrim haya ratzon lirdof achareihem, mekevan shamitzrim chafsu latzil klei hakesef hazahav shenignu hayadam b'ashalah. That's the Ran Rabbeinu Nissim. The real apex, the climax of Yetziat Mitzrayim is only at Kriyas Yamsuf, when the sea split, the Egyptians are drowned, Klai Yisrael are able to say, Zeh Keli Vaveu, this is my God and I will glorify him, this is the full Amun in Hashem, this was it. How did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create the scenario, so to speak, that the Egyptians were going to be lured into the water? And that is because they wanted to get their loot back. They see that here they thought, as we'll talk about, the Jews were just going for 3 days. A week has passed and they're not coming back. Oh my gosh, they have all my silver, they have all my gold, my candlesticks, my goblets, oh my! So they ran after the Jews in order to get all these things. So why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu want them to borrow it? This was part of Hashem's greater plan, because this was going to create the greatest Kiddush Hashem possible. When you see by Rachel, when she describes to the Meraglim, to the spies, what was the fear that overcame the people of the land, it was Kriyas Yam Suf. It was the way the sea split. That was just had the most powerful impact on everyone. And this is what this Forno says as well. The Bnei Yisrael didn't want to borrow from the Egyptians because they were afraid that if they were going to borrow, the Egyptians would be hot on their trail. So why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to implore them by Kriyas Yam Suf to borrow, by Mitzrayim, to implore them to take the stuff, but by Kriyas Yam Suf he didn't? The answer is clear. By the story in Egypt, they were afraid to borrow from the people because they knew that this was just going to be an excuse for them to run after them. However, once the Egyptians had drowned and that fear was no longer relevant, so of course they wanted to take all the booty that they could, and that's the distinction between Egypt and Kriyas Yam Suf, which answers the Chasam Sofer's question. Another way the old Moshe describes the answer to this question of the distinction between in Egypt and the splitting of the sea by one, Moshe Rabbeinu had implored them, Daber Na, and the other, they took it very, very freely and willingly. It's the idea, more of a philosophical idea, that Ohev Kesev Lo Yispa Kesev, someone who loves money is never going to be satisfied with money. Pasuk in Koheler. And that's why a person who has 100 wants 200. So in Egypt, when they were slaves, they had no real value of money. They hadn't tasted money. So for them, there was no desire, really, to have this money. So you almost had to, like, tell them, you know, money is a good thing. You should go ask for it. It's an important thing. However, once they've tasted the taste of money, then the Taivas HaMamon came into them, and now, already by Kriyas Yam Suf, they have that desire. And now they want more and more. And the Chasam Sofer adds, Shekol taiva sa'ish l'kesef hu kulo yetzahara. The desire for money is coming from a place of the yetzahara. However, the money that they took in Egypt, which created this tremendous Kiddush Hashem, because the nation saw the revelation, the Jewish people saw the revelation of God so clearly at the splitting of the sea. And this was by taking their money, the reason the Egyptians ran after them and this whole thing happened. That money didn't have a Yitzhahara attached to it. Why? Because that money didn't have anything negative. It was only for Kiddush Hashem. And indeed, that money was used to build the Mishkan. However, the money for the Kriyas Yam Suf, the money at that time, already the taiva of the Yetzirah came on them, and that's what Moshe Rabbeinu means. Rashi brings down by Di Zahav, when Moshe Rabbeinu says, what do you expect from them? Of course they made an Egel HaZahav. You gave them so much money. What do you think they're going to do with it? That's the money that's a reference to the splitting of the sea. And there's a great piece that Rav Chaim Shmulevitz brings down. And he says, you can have two people. One person has $1,000. Another person has $100. Who is the one in greater need? So we would say the one with $100. No, no, no. The one with $100 wants double. He wants $200. The one with $1,000 wants double. He wants $2,000. So who's the one in the greater need? The one who has $1,000, not $100. It gives us a vantage point, a view of the way money is understood. That obviously money can be used for the good, no doubt about it. However, the drive for more and more money, the inability to be satiated with the money that we have, is a drive coming from the Yetzirah, from the negative part of ourselves, just to be able to accumulate more and more. And this is exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu understood, and why he wanted the people to borrow these things, because he knew that the Egyptians were going to run after the Jews for this very thing. Rosh Hadron in Lev Shalom develops this. And he quotes the Rashi in source number 10, that the heart of Paro and the Egyptians were turned, and they ran after the Jews. So Rashi says, what do you mean it was turned? Because Sharia Amar Lahem Kumutsu Mitochami. They had said, okay, go, be my guest. V'nefach Luvav Avadav, and suddenly the servant's heart turned around, and they said, oh my gosh, we have to run after them. Why? Here's the key phrase. Bishvil mamonam shehi shilum. Because of the money that they borrowed and didn't return. This is it. What was the impetus to run after the Jews? The impetus was to be able to get back the money. And as Rosh Hashanah points out in source number 14, you may say the impetus was to get them back as slaves. Well, there's two problems with that. One is already for that whole year they weren't slaves anymore. So that idea of wanting them as slaves is not as profound and as, on the front of their minds. And B, you take a look at the Shira, Erdov, Asig, Achalek, Shalau. They were there to murder, to kill. They wanted to take the Jews and murder them. So they're going to take back their coffins and have them as a monument for slavery? They weren't there to get the Jews back. They were there to get the money, Achalek, Shalau, to get the booty. And they would do whatever they needed to do to get that booty. Their whole focus was just one focus, the focus of money. And Rav Shadon develops this idea, and it's so practical for our lives, that the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu understood, borrow the money, that they're going to think they're going to get paid back, and they don't get paid back, and they get upset, and therefore they're going to run after you, is really not only talking about the Egyptians, it's talking about you and I, about our running after and our desire for money. And he says, logically, we're back in source 10, logically, these people just went through 10 makos. The last one was the most severe. They had just buried their firstborns, right? Ein bayit asher ein shameh. There's no house that doesn't have someone that died. They're in a state of avelos, they're in a state of mourning. Now, let me ask you, if a whole country is in a state of mourning, is this a time to think about, oh, my candlesticks, oh, my golden goblet? No, it's a time to think about how your country is in ruin and how you lost so many people and just buried all these dead. That would be logical. But the people don't do that. They do something that's so counterintuitive, we would think. And they say is, okay, the dead is dead. It's buried. It's long buried. 3 days, long buried. But what about our goblets? What about our candlesticks? What about our silver boxes? That's a worry on our heads right now. And they run after the Jews. What would allow a person to think in such a warped, corrupted way? V'shlosha tevot charashi mevarot lanu akol. B'shvil mamunam shishilum, the asterisks in 11, for the money that they borrowed. Klomar kaf samech pesofi kesef. Money. Hinei lanu shetayvas hamamo ma'arera ereinei hadam lufato sh'ola. Money is something that drags a person down to the very depth. Ad she'im she'am shalem, to the extent that a whole nation is going to go out. And really, it's a suicide mission based on their past experience with the Jews in order to get money. V'likishit bonei nireh zo she'tchuna zu she'maisa she'gayo v'shtud kayemet rak b'tayva samamam. This craziness, this ability to warp one's thinking. You know this about bribes. The Chumash tells us that bribes, shochad yaver einei tzadikim, einei pikrim, it blinds the eyes of those that are smart. Once someone gets around with money, you don't see clearly anymore. And suddenly you make all these excuses and you do all these things because money blinds the person. And so you take a look, continues Rav Chardon in Source 12, and you think, okay, these guys are crazy. You know, they're running after money. They're basically running, you know, into a hornet's nest. Like, why would they do this? But we're above this. Listen to the Rambam. This is the Rambam in his Akdama to Perush HaMishnayos, bottom of 12. Ha'omer shidulei ha'mishtagim haya olam ha'charev. Those that say, if it wasn't for the crazy ones, the world would be destroyed. Umarich l'ta'er ech yivla adam emeitav shirotav. He said, let's describe how a person spends most of their best years of their life. V'yarchik nidod b'yamim u'benarot. And they wander over, you know, mountains and rivers. V'yisakein en nefsho. And they put their lives in danger from heat and coldness. V'yatria b'kol kochol shanim rabot lekod kesef. And why does a person work so hard? Why do people travel from to China across the world? To get money. V'kol kidei shebiyom min hayamim. And this is the Rambam. And this is all. That one day, it will come the point that a person will see that I'm too tired to travel anymore. And I can now take the money that I have and I can now build a house that will last for 300 years. Even though this person knows that they don't have just but a couple of years, a handful of years to live. And this house, Shebahem Yuchal Yistapek B'Binyan Hasui Megemet Bilvat. And how sturdy is this house? How good is this house? This is what we are talking about. The Tarbut Mitzrayim, the mindset of Egypt, is something that overtakes us. How many times are we working, and do we ever really enjoy life? Because I'm so busy working, where do we have the ability to be present for our family, for ourselves, for our health, for what life has to offer, for Kedusha, for Torah, Mitzvot, Chesed? You know, it's that story, we'll just adapt it, of the fellow who is fishing, has a little house on the water, and he goes out every morning on his little fishing boat, and he takes out his net, and he sits on the boat, you know, enjoying the sunshine, and he brings in a couple of fish, and he makes that for his meal, and this is how he spends his day. A fellow comes over to him and says, you know, I'm watching you, you're really a good fisherman, it's really a waste that you're just bringing in a few fish. So the fellow says, well, what do you think I should do? I'll tell you what you should do. You should sell this boat and buy a much bigger boat, and then put out much bigger nets. And that way, you'll get much more fish. Okay, and then what should I do? Okay, then when you have more fish, then you'll sell that fish and you'll be able to open up an export business of selling fresh fish and you'll make a lot of money. Right, then what should I do? Then you should build a house in the city and a big mansion in order to enjoy the wealth that you have. Okay, and then what should I do? And then you should, you know, continue in your business until it grows and grows. Okay, and then what? And then when you're really, really at the top of your business, sell everything, buy a little house by the water, and just sit on a boat and fish for yourself. Rabosai, the circular reasoning is so often in our mindset. We're saving for, we're working for. What's it all about? What's life all about? What this piece in the Leif Shalom is about is not just about the Egyptians running after the Jews for that which was borrowed from them. This is a description that's supposed to, you know, propel us into deeper thinking and into a mindset of what are we chasing after? Why are we chasing after this? What is really important? What are our values in life? And how do I make sure that those values are aligned with the goals that I have for myself? And this is a very important question to ask. Representila Yeager in the Sefer Step by Step has a piece on Taiva, and she brings down Rabbeinu Bachya and Kara Kemach under Chemda, stresses Source 15, and not only is it prohibit to covet anything that is your neighbor's, but it's even forbidden to covet your own possessions, i.e. do not love even your own money. Greed can reduce a person to being selfish, tight-fisted, and unable to give tzedakah and do other mitzvahs. The Torah establishes tachmod, don't be desired, don't covet, as a tenth of the Aser HaDibrot, because it's considered equal to all the commandments. It's also the tenth commandment. It serves as a reminder that a yid has to give meiser, one-tenth of his earnings, to tzedakah. The person who tends towards being greedy must remember that part of what Hashem bequeathed to him belongs to those who are less fortunate. And this is the idea Rabbi Yerucham speaks about, that this is the message when Moshe Rabbeinu caused Israel's journey from the Sea of Reeds, that Moshe Rabbeinu was telling them, it's too much. There is a limit. How much do you really need? And take what you really need and use it. But beyond that, what is it all for? The Sefer Ha'aros, Rav Zadel Epstein, in Source 17, describes this so beautifully. He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar LeMoshe, in the arrow, Daber Nabas Ne'am V'Yishalu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMade Eklai Yisrael Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim. Hashem is teaching the Jewish people of Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim through this imagery of borrowing, Musag Chadash B'Rechush Gato, what it means to have wealth, B'She'ela Munach Ha'osher Achi Gato, by borrowing. This is the greatest message we can have about our wealth. Mishum shizoi hakara shema sheyesh, yesh. Uma she'ein lo tzarich. What I have is what I need. And if I don't have it, it means I don't need it. Va'idiya hazon chashuva ma'od dafka b'yitzhiyat Mitzrayim. This is teaching you who is the me'ushar, who is the happy one, who is the satisfied one, and who is the eved shafel. This is the message to be gained. This is a message to be gleaned. That life is about, we're all on borrowed time. None of this belongs to us. The imagery of borrowing, again, the first level is Klapei Shmaya in relation to the Kadosh Baruch Hu on the one. The borrowing created a Kiddush Hashem. The borrowing created that they would run after them, and that would create the story of Kriyas Yam. So that's idea one. And the second idea of the Klapei Shmaya is that the borrowing image was an image that Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted to imbue in the people, that we really own nothing, that everything that we have is borrowed. And we have to look at it from that perspective, that I think, I was reading just recently, I don't remember the whole story, of somebody who had this few million dollars in the bank, and he only has 7 tries to remember the code, and he lost the code, and the money's in the bank, and he can't get it because he doesn't have the code. I mean, it's something so ridiculous you can't even imagine. Rabbi Osai, that's all of us. The code is understanding that all money is borrowed, that Kadosh Baruch Hu's lending it to us while we're on earth. And we say, the Kapitul Tehillim tells us, Ki lo b'moto yikach ha'ko, lo yered acharav kodo. You don't take it with you, my friends. The only thing you take with you are the Torah and the mitzvot that you do with the money. The understanding how you are utilizing the money for greater good. And that was the message that Klal Yisrael had to learn. Klapei Shmaya, in relation to Kadosh Baruch Hu, everything is about Kiddushim Shemayim, recognize that we're living on that which is borrowed. We'll just complete this first level of what is the idea of Reim here, of Ish L'Reyehu. So Rav Schwab notes the following in 18. Many commentators ask, Hashem intended to fulfill his promise only so that Avram could not have any complaints? Doesn't Hashem fulfill his promise simply because he made them? And again, this is really a shear in its own right. The answer lies in how one defines wealth. Most people, if they possess many resources, consider themselves wealthy, regardless of how these resources were obtained. Agravino, however, didn't consider assets that came from spoils of war wealth. He didn't take the spoils from stone. We sold a few a while ago in Sefer Breshi, not even a string or a shoelace, because he didn't want anything that had been acquired as a result of bloodshed or strife. Similarly, Avram gave all the gifts he had received from Avimelech to his concubine children because they were not given to him out of love. Avram Avinu would not have been satisfied had the Jews acquired the Egyptians' riches through battle, or even had the Egyptian given the Jews begrudgingly of their wealth. This was because to Avraham the only true gift was one that was given wholeheartedly with love, and only such a gift could be considered great wealth. And therefore Hashem granted favor in the eyes of the Egyptian. That's the idea of Ish L'Re'ehu, Isha L'Re'uta, it's friendship. That when it was given over with love. That type of money that's not coming from strife and from arguments and from machloket and from lawsuits, but it's coming from a place of peace, a place of making shalom, that's the type of money that Avraham Avinu wanted to make sure that his children would have. And therefore, Kadosh Baruch Hu asked, look at your neighbor as a Reya, as a friend, and we know the way you look at others, others will look at you. They will likewise give it back to you as a friend, and Hashem as well engendered in them a sense of chen, a sense of favor, that they found favor in the eyes of the Egyptians, and it was given with love. That, my friends, is level number one, Klape Shmaya, by having it borrowed, that created a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. And the message for us, beware of money. People literally kill themselves, health and everything, just to accumulate more and more. Those who have 100 want 2, those who have 1,000 want 2,000. Who is the one in greater need? Ask yourself that question. Second level. A very, very powerful piece, very contemporary. B'karei Shema Rav Birnbaum Tzatzal, source 20. And he again asks this question. He says, why is it that they have to give it in this way? Give it as a gift. What's going on here? So he says, U'bichdei l'va'er zo nere lakvi madi asad hagrach, Reb Chaim Halevi Brisker Rav. We know that if a person injures another person, so then there are five things they have to pay. They have to pay their medical expense, they have to pay the embarrassment, they have to pay for the work that they've lost, there's different things. So one of the things they have to pay for is the pain that they've gone through. Now, let me tell you a secret. No one can pay for pain, right? Pain is its own category. So, lamro ma de'ein b'tzar nezek mamon klal, even though you can't put a price tag on pain, v'haynu shichiva tara tamazik l'shalem gam al ha'in ne'imud v'arikshei ha'tzar hanigramim l'alzulam mechamat meisa hezek shalo, av opishim m'tziu sadvarim yevshar l'malot have said as a lie, de tashlum ha'kesev b'vat. This is Xeris HaKatov. This is what Hashem has deemed what we need to do. Even though the pain is so great, unless you can turn that pain into real joy, it's so hard to even, you know, give a price tag to embarrassment, to pain, to humiliation, to any of these emotional feelings. Nevertheless, says the Brisker Rav, even though you can't put a price tag on it, this is Xeris HaKatov. Shechiva Tarat HaMazik. A person has to pay for what they've injured their friend. Okay, with this in mind, we can appreciate the following. Here, when the Egyptians understood that they tormented the Jews, they hurt the Jews, if they were to give the Jewish people money and say, you know what, we've persecuted you for the last 210 years, really bad 86 of those years, and now I want to give you compensation money for all that we hurt you, for all the humiliation we caused you, for all the pain, for all the agony, for all the times we beat you up. Now let's look at it from both sides. From the side of the Egyptians, they would have been very happy. V'im kol zeh hayu niftarim im hargasha, and the asterisk, ni'imash asu heim et hadavar atob biyoter, v'tiknu ad aviyutav. The Egyptians would feel good, you know, everyone has a little bit of a, usually, conscience, you know, I shouldn't have been so mean, but if I paid the person, okay, Doesn't matter what I've done. I've paid it. I've gone it. You know, it's off of my head. Ubiyot hargasha zu belev ha-mitzrim lo haya ke'ev ve'nui nishkach melev ha-yudim. Had the Egyptians done that, it wouldn't have taken away an iota of the pain the Jews would have felt, because the Egyptians would not have felt any level of remorse, culpability, or responsibility. And that is why the Jews didn't want to take this money. They didn't want to take this money because they didn't want the Egyptians to feel like, oh, they're off the hook now. Shelo yachshavu v'yidmu belibam sheke'ilu pa'alu davar tov im kaspam. Ah, we've done something good with our money. U'mechamat kein usava davar she'adarabba. Rak yishalu amamonam l'Yisrael b'tikva sheyichzor lahem. V'shelo b'datam v'rtonam yichtaf v'hem amonam shelo yichzor lahem olamim. So had the Egyptians given to them, right? Not borrowed. Had the Jews said, you know what? Oh, pay up. You hurt us, you embarrassed us, you humiliated us, you tortured us, pay us money. Had the Egyptians paid them money, so then they would have said, okay, so we did some mean things, but we're now, you know, we're even, so to speak. The Jews couldn't handle that. They didn't want that. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no. What we're going to do is we're going to have them, you're going to have you borrow the money. And that way, the Egyptians don't ease their consciousness because they feel like they're going to get their money back, and in no way have they really paid and compensated for what they've done. And this he brings down, and the old Moshe brings down as well, as that this is two sides of the coin. And again, we are not in a position to even comment on this with the German reparations money as well. And this was the question. Where there is two different sides in the bracket of 22. Satam omrim, ha'im ritzochenu yiyu gam yorshenu. Those who murdered us are going to be the ones who we're going to inherit. Like, we don't want anything to do with the Egyptians. The satam omrim, she'en lam Yisrael lavom, b'shum mekach v'memkar mishayim elu, v'lam yomru b'goyim shlakachnu kofer l'nefesh atinu, sheshefchu et damam kamayim. So this is the side of it, that there is a side of taking it, of compensation, and then there's the other side that says, nothing that they give me will ever compensate for what they've done, and I don't want them to even think that they're not guilty, they don't have to feel this way at all. And this was the challenge that Klal Yisrael had, and it's a very deep psychological issue. People have hurt you. Does money pay back for what you've experienced or not? Kadosh Baruch Hu not wanting the Egyptians off the hook, recognizing this pain of the Jews, says, you know what? We're going to make it difficult for them. They're going to pay you the money, which means you're going to get compensated, but they're not going to pay you the money in a way where they are now off the hook. They're going to pay you the money thinking they're going to get it back. It's just borrowed money. And in that way, it's a win-win situation. The other aspect he brings down is, and this is very fascinating, is that this is a midah keneged midah, a measure for measure. And we'll just summarize 23 and 24. How did the Egyptians get the Jews into servitude in the first place? Do you remember? Avodat perach beperach, with a soft tongue. They said to the Jews, you know what? We have a very, very, very important job to build these pyramids, and we are giving tremendous compensation. And the harder you work, the more money you get. Well, if a person thinks they're getting money for working hard, they push themselves to their utmost. And the Jews, you know, put in 15-hour days. And then the Egyptians said to them, ah, now that I see you can work 15-hour days, now you're going to start working 15-hour days with this one catch. There's no money attached. And that's how they got the Jews over a period of time into slavery. So this idea of getting the Jews into slavery by duping them, by tricking them, this is the exact measure for measure. So we spoke about last week how Hashem is so careful to reward and punish measure for measure, how they are being punished measure for measure. Here they're being told, you know, the Jews are going on a 3-day journey. They need to have these silver and gold in order to serve their God. And the Egyptians mind, it's a 3-day journey, and they're going to get paid back. And they don't. So just like they duped the Jews into thinking that they were going to get paid, and they didn't. Now the Egyptians think that they're going to get compensated or get their items returned, and they don't. We see here how exact nothing goes unnoticed by the Ribono Shel Olam. How indeed did the Jews impact the Egyptians to give them this money? What was some of the tactics that were used? So I'd like to share a number of insights. The first is the Nir Uziel brings a medrash of Uziel Malevsky. He brings a medrash in 27, where the medrash says that we know the classic medrash that in the Makas Choshech, that the Jews were able to see what the Egyptians weren't able to see. They had the supernal light which God stored away for the righteous. With this light, they were able to discern the location of hidden valuables that the Egyptians themselves did not know they owned. It's not just what was in their house. The Torah relates the Egyptians were more than willing to comply with the Jews' request that they lend them their valuable objects. In many cases, though, they did not realize they possessed vast treasure buried in their field. Their ancestor has concealed these fortunes in the heyday of Egyptian prosperity, when all the nations of the world had been forced to buy provisions from Yosef. The descendants of these prosperous Egyptians eventually lost track of the exact locations of the buried treasure, and as time wore on, the very existence of such treasures was in question. And now, the Jews come, and they say to the Egyptians, you know, you have treasures buried here, there, and locate all of these places. And the Egyptians, and Rav Hirsch picks up on this in 28, the Egyptians were so impressed with the moral conscience of the Jew. Like, whoa, you knew about not only the things in their house, obviously they know they'd be stolen, they wouldn't even recognize that these treasures were buried in their backyard or down the road. They wouldn't even know had the Jews taken it. And here the Jews were above board and honest and said, we didn't touch it. We know it's there. And we're asking for it from you now. So first of all, the Jews looked like very honest and upright people. So when the Jews are saying, and this is the idea that Rav Bilsky develops at length in Ene Yisrael, the whole gimmick or scheme until now has been, we are going, and that's the whole back and forth, we are going to serve God for a 3-day holiday. Right? Who's going to go? Will those cattle go? Will the children go? Will the women go? It's all back and forth about 3 days, a 3-day journey. So in the Egyptians' mind, where are the Jews going? In somewhere in their mind, they're thinking, you know what? They're going for 3 days. And we can trust these people because, after all, they had the ability to take all of our jewels and the hidden things, and they did. So obviously, if they're telling us they're going for a 3-day journey, we can believe them. And that was part of what enabled the Jews to dupe the Egyptians. Let's look at Rav Bilsky inside. As the Makos, source 30, came to a close and everyone realized the Jews were finally going to celebrate their holiday, the excitement grew. Everyone, even the midstream, understood that one prepares for a festival by donning the finest clothes and jewelry. It was equally clear that the enslaved Jews were entirely unprepared for the festival which they were about to celebrate. So, thus, Hashem granted the people favor in the eyes of the midstream, as if they too were planning the Jews' celebration. The midstream looked up at Esau and saw them in a new light, forgetting the contempt they previously felt for them. These poor, begraggled slaves, dressed in the shabbiest, simplest garments, were about to set off and celebrate a great festival. It may be imagined that the Egyptians approached the Jews with words such as these. Look at you. How can you go to such a grand event looking like that? How can you take those earrings? Here, take these earrings, this fine necklace. Wait, I'll bring you my beautiful new gown. Imagine being there. What it must have felt like for a lowly and degraded slave to suddenly find his former taskmaster giving him all these things. And now we can appreciate the only way Kleiso had been able to borrow this great wealth from the Egyptian neighbors if they suddenly found favor in their eyes. Otherwise, the request may have been met with scorn and a flat refusal. says Rapelski, they bought it. They bought it hook, line, and sinker. They're going for a three-day festival. They need these things for a three-day festival, and they are providing them these things. And in the Egyptian's mind, again, the honesty of the Jew, all of these things are going to be returned. And the measure for measure is, right, second levels about the Egyptians, is the Egyptians deserve, because of the way they duped the Jews, to be duped, as well as they needed to compensate. That was only right for all the affliction they had done. At the same time, Hashem didn't want them to have the good feeling, to be off their conscience of how they behave, by, so to speak, just paying it off and saying, you know what, we're going to pay as a compensation for the pain that you felt. However, there is another approach to how the Egyptians were duped. And this is a very beautiful Malbim. Says the Malbim, however, because the verse 32 says that each man should borrow from his friend and each woman from her friend, the verse seems to imply that the Jews were to borrow from one another, from their fellow Jews, right? Level number one, Re'ehu, is the Egyptian. That Hashem made them find favor in their eyes because Hashem knew that Avraham Avinu would only like wealth given out of love. No, 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 says the second level. Re'ehu is not a non-Jew. Re'ehu throughout, v'ahavta re'echa kamocha throughout, is a Jew. The Jews were to borrow from one another, from their fellow Jews, for the verse would not refer to Egyptians as friends of the Jewish people. It appears, therefore, that there was a different sort of subterfuge at work here, so the Egyptians should not realize that the Jews were borrowing without intention to return, as follows. It should have seemed odd to the Egyptians that the Jews would require silver and gold items for their worship. And this should have aroused their suspicion when the Jews asked for such. Right, clothes I get, jewelry I get, but why do you need gold and silver bowls and cups? But when they saw the Jews themselves borrowing each man from his friend, Jew from Jew, the poorer Jews borrowing silver and gold vessels from the wealthier ones, the Egyptians said to themselves that these valuable items must indeed be requirements for the worship that the Jews were soon to perform, and requirements for the accompanying festivals. It must be, they reasoned, that this particular form of worship required that each Israelite, even the poorest among them, be equipped with jewelry and precious items of gold and silver. After borrowing from each other, the Jews could then borrow from the Egyptians, the asterisks in 33, without arousing suspicion. So the Ish L'Re'ehu was a Jew borrowed from Jew, and that was part of the subterfuge. On this, the Mishnat Shem and Rav Kaufman brings an idea from the Gra, and it's also found in the Kiddushei Harim. And as I've said many times, it's usually, there has to be one idea that I feel so sparked, like, wow, it's for this idea, it's worth, with Siyata Deshmaya, to daven, to build a whole shiur around this idea. It's like one brick, and the whole shiur is built around it. This is the brick that so inspired me that this topic was chosen, and that's the following. Listen closely. This idea of Jew borrowing from Jew and then Jew borrowing from Egyptian is not just about Egypt. It's about a yesod for life. What is this? He says, in those days, mipnei shebiyamim halalu adayin, in the bracket in 34, lo haya ba'olam ruach kdusha shel midas havasranos. There didn't exist in this world the idea of being mevater, of giving of yourself to another person, of sharing. We know that the world is really, you know, goes on the course of the way the Jews set it, right? They're the captain of the ship. They set the course. The way the Jews act, the world is going to act accordingly. V'hainu, therefore, should call old lo asu b'nei so maiso shavasronos v'shel chesed. As long as Jew didn't borrow from another Jew, it would have been impossible for the Egyptians to also lend to a Jew, because they wouldn't have been in the teva of the world. It was only by Jew borrowing from another Jew that opened up the fountain of the concept of what borrowing is all about, right? In those days, no one borrowed sugar from a friend. It was such a concept. Go to the store, get it yourself, whatever it is. V'lachin rak lachar shebnei Yisrael yichvu et Yitzram beinam levein atzmam. It was only when Klal Yisrael forced themselves to do this stuck of a chesed, this act of kindness each among each other, that impacted the world with a spirit of holiness, of purity, and then they could only then turn to their neighbors to ask to lend them things. The Yesh B'Rayon Zeh Musar Haskel Amok in the Aaron 34, there is a very deep idea here. Because here we learn, Shemasav Hapshutim, simple acts that we do, Shuase, that whatever we do, Yesh Lahem Hashpa'a Al Kol Seder Ha'olam V'Tachlotav, has an impact on the entire world. Uba Ofen Kazeh, and in this way, everything that we do, whether it's good or not good, makes an impression on the world. And the whole world is impacted by this. The Beis Halevi, developing this idea, says that when a person does something good or bad, they create in the world a teva, a nature, that this becomes the nature of the world. And it doesn't matter if you do this publicly or privately. It still makes an impression in the world. Even if you sin in a private type of way, you are creating taiva. You're creating desire in that place. We've seen this idea before, if you may recall. Which means, a person goes down the street, and they see something that's inappropriate to see. Use your imagination. I'm not going to give you suggestions. So instead of looking away, they have two options. They can look away right away. At the moment they look away right away, that power of taiva, of desire, has moved down a notch, and the next person that's going to walk down that same street is not going to have the same pull to look at that scene, or whatever it is. On the flip side, the person succumbs to their taiva, to their desire, and they stare at it, and they get whatever pleasure out of it. What then happens is one creates an aura in that place, that this is a place of desire. And the next fellow walking down, even if he wasn't planning on looking, there's going to be something that's going to draw them to look at this and to get this forbidden pleasure. Whoa. My friends, do you understand the implications of this? We are creating realities wherever we go, for the good and for the opposite. Every time I go somewhere and I say Kapitel Tehillim and I do an act of chesed and I say a bracha out loud, I create kedusha in this place, and this place then has an attraction. It's like putting magnetic field, an attraction to holiness, or God forbid the other way. And this explains when Chazal say that Chazal say, Zachat Tzadik Notel Chalko V'Chelech Chaveru B'Gan Eden. A Tzadik can not only get their own portion in Gan Eden, but their friend's portion. You have impacted other people. And it goes the opposite as well. So that when you create, when one creates positive energy by doing mitzvahs, by thinking positive thoughts, by overcoming desires, all of these things, when the next person is going to be successful overcoming the temptation, or is going to be drawn to doing a chesed or a mitzvah in this place, the credit also goes to you because you've created that aura. My friends, don't you feel like turning off the shir now, even though we only have a few minutes left, and going out and creating force fields of kedusha, of mitzvah, of like just singing, well, maybe not literally singing in the streets, but doing chesed and mitzvahs and just creating this kedusha power in the world? Wow! But you don't even have to go out into the streets. We know in 36, the Gemara tells us, based on a pasuk in Chavakut, Beit Yer Aleph, Ki Eve Mikir Tizak V'Kapitz Me'et Yanena. Without looking at the context of the pasuk in Chavakut, the pasuk literally means the stone from the wall cries out and the beam of wood responds. Which means the Gemara in Tanis Yer Aleph and Aleph tells us that the very walls of our house are me'idim al adam shasadin. They are the ones that testify for everything we said and did in our house. But it's more than that. We create the environment in our house. As Yireh be'nav shekol prat b'pat nirshav v'nikap b'karot beito. Everything I do, it's not like the wall is standing static. It's dynamic. It's taking in positive energy, taking out negative energy, taking in negative energy. It's a continuous change of vibes. They're screaming, they're yelling, they're talking to each other. The parts of the house, they feel it. And you know, my friends, we know this to be so true. You walk into some houses and you say, wow, Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, doesn't matter where you are. Because you feel that this house has that energy, that positivity found there. Okay, my friends, let's summarize level number 2. And then the last few minutes, we'll look at level number 3. Number 1, Klapei Shmaya, Kiddush Hashem, recognizing that wealth is all borrowed. It's all borrowed money. Level number 2, it's all about the Egyptians. We don't want the Egyptians to feel good as if they're off the hook. Also, the way the Egyptians aren't have to compensate, but now with a good feeling. Also, it's a mita k'neged mita, a measure for measure, the way they were. They duped the Jews, they're duped in the same way, losing money at the end of this experience. How are they able to dupe Egyptians? They're not stupid. One is, it was the energy that there's a holiday going on, and Hashem granted favor, and they're giving their stuff for this holiday. Or they saw Jews borrowing from other Jews, and they said that this is what they do for their festival. They borrow these things. They need these things. That was part of the subterfuge. On a deeper level, the Jew borrowing from the Jew was in order to create an energy in the world called borrowing, an energy in the world called giving freely. That energy the Jews had to create. And this idea of creating energy is utilized in our lives all the time. When people are careful, whether it's in their own homes, in the world at large, in their office place, whatever it is, to have things that remind them of the Kedusha and Tara, of the purity and holiness that a Jew should live in, so then it's a different dynamic. The air, everything around you is different. And I've seen this over and over again, that when a parent makes a certain change, without even telling the kids, suddenly you'll find that change is going to happen in the house, and the kids are going to suddenly, almost through osmosis, pick up this change as well. It's in the air. We have such an awesome responsibility. The final idea, my friends, the borrowing has nothing to do with Klapei Shmaya, about the Kiddush Hashem, and not about the Egyptians. It has everything to do with the Jews. How so? So, I'd like to do a piece from Shlita Pinchas for Pinchas Friedman Shlita, a little bit of Bill's Torah in 38b. He brings the Rashbam. The Rashbam brings, Rashbam it's a Pashtan, really the way the simple interpretation, Vaishalu Lasho Matana, Kamo Sha'almi Meni Vetana Goyim Nechlosecha. That when we're talking about Vaishalu, it's not that they're borrowing, they're asking it as a gift. So the word Vaishalu can have two meanings. It can mean that they're asking it as a gift, and with no thought of giving back, and the Egyptians knew that. Or Vaishalu can be borrowed, and the Egyptians expected to get it back. How do we understand this dynamics? So let's begin in 38a, that there's a wonderful explanation in the commentary of the Rebbein Bechaye. He explains that prior to Matan Torah, all human beings were friends, like one people. After Matan Torah, after Hashem offered the Torah to each and every nation, they all refused it, except for Klal Yisrael. The other nations were excluded from the category of brothers and fellows. Subsequently, this description only applied to Yisrael, and we have this, Leman Achai Verei, for the sake of my brothers and my fellows, which refers to the Jewish people. Yeah. And as well as he asks, why is it, with the way we began, that Moshe Rabbeinu is told this Nevuah about taking the items at the same time as being told at Makas Becharos, the death of the firstborn? There has to be a connection. Again, there's a lot written on this. 39. There's a well-known question in the world of Drush, brought down by the Bnei Sfaschar in the name of the great Chida. According to the Medrash in Tanit Beliyahu Zuta, Yaakov and Esav divided the worlds between them. Esav took out his portion Olam Haza, this world, and Yaakov took his portion Olam Haba. This being the case, how are we allowed to benefit from the pleasures and good of Olam Havzeh? It doesn't belong to us. It belongs to Esav. So one of the answers is that when the Chumash writes, Vayera Vayboker Yom HaShishi, that the whole world was waiting for the Yom HaShishi, the sixth day, for the Jews to return to accept the Torah. And Hashem says, if Yisrael accept my Torah, then all is well. But if they do not, I will return the world to chaos and void. The world cannot continue to exist without Torah. Now, from the perspective of the other nations who refused to accept the Torah, the world should have returned to chaos and void. They owe their continued existence to the Jewish people, for by accepting the Torah, they saved the world from annihilation. Now, there is an explicit halacha in the Gemara that a person who saves an object from the bottom of the sea, zuto shel yam, or from the surge of a river, it belongs to him. Why? Because there's no way that this person was ever going to retrieve it. Thus, by accepting the Torah, Yisrael also acquired a portion of Olam Hazeh for themselves, because it was tantamount to saving the world from certain loss, like from the bottom of the sea. Therefore, Yisrael are entitled to enjoy all the benefits of Olam Hazeh. Now we come to the punchline. For we can now comprehend why Hashem employed the word Vayishalu, which could be understood in two different ways. With regard to the Egyptians, Hashem meant for the Jewish people to request the expensive vessels as gift to compensate them for their servitude. That was from their perspective. With regards to the Jewish people, however, Hashem wanted them to recognize beyond a shadow of a doubt that all the Egyptian property currently in their possession had the status of a loan and borrowed items. The status of that property hinged on the Jewish people accepting the Torah in the third month after the exodus from Egypt. If they accepted the Torah, they'd be saving the world from Zuto Shoyam and would remain in their possession as legitimate gifts. If, however, they did not accept the Torah and did not save the world from annihilation, they'd be prohibited from utilizing and continuing to benefit from the Egyptian property. They would have to return it because it would remain part of Esav's heritage. With this understanding, we can now understand, please speak in the ears of the people. 41, it was as if he was being instructed to whisper a secret in their ears. In truth, with regards to Egyptians, they're being asked to give the item to the Jews. With regards to Israel, however, they're being given a secret message. The items they were receiving were, in the meantime, only loans and not true gifts until they accepted the Torah. And that is hinted at in the word Re'ehu fellows. As we learned from Beinu Bechaya prior to Marz and Torah, human beings were friends like one. So in light of what we have learned, Hashem wanted to emphasize why he employed the ambiguous term Vayishalu, which could imply a loan or a gift. At that point in time, the Egyptians had still categorized as a fellow because they had not yet accepted the Torah. Hence, all of the Egyptians' property and their possessions were still considered to be borrowed. They were Re'ehuts before Torah. However, the moment they were accepted Torah, then these borrowed gifts would become theirs permanently, absolute gifts. And this is why in 42, it's connected with Makas Bechoros. Because Makas Bechoros was the clincher that Hashem says, B'ni Bechori Yisrael. The Jewish people are referred to as the firstborn, that they are given that status of the ones who are the chosen nations. They are given the status of the ones who are going to receive the Torah. And therefore, the receiving of the gifts and the receiving of the Torah and the firstborn nature of the Jews are really one and the same and interconnected. And this is the message for our lives. We merit the brachos of Olam Hazeh at the end of 42 only on the condition that we accept the Torah. This is a vital lesson for all the people of Israel in every generation. If we wish to attain the abundant bracha related to matters of the physical world, the Olam Hazeh, it is imperative that we accept upon ourselves the yoke of Torah, in whose merit the world exists and endures. In this manner, the words of the pasuk become a reality. Length of days is at its right, at its left, wealth and honor. A pasuk that we say when seeing Hagbah lifting up, it's to remind us that the Torah being lifted up in our lives, the focal aspect, is predicated on accepting the Torah, and then we have a right to the physical possessions that we have. So really, the beginning of the Shir and the end of the Shir now come full circle. The message here is very clear. Hashem gives us these things, and they're very special things. However, recognize that really all of these things are given to us on a loan, as a gift. What are the terms of this loan? Then Hashem says, enjoy Olam Hazeh. Enjoy the pleasures of this world. But enjoy them within the rubric of Torah. Because that's the only way you deserve them. Otherwise, just give them back to the nations. This world belongs to Esav. We have to understand the mindset we have to have for money, the mindset we have to have for the physical possession, is it's all on borrowed terms. That everything we have is given to us as a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we have to have that clarity and learn from the Egyptians. What are we running after? They ran into the sea to get some silver goblets and basically killed themselves. For what? We have to be careful that we don't follow suit and also drown ourselves in these luxuries and pleasures. At what expense? The world is here for enjoyment. The world is here for connection. The world is here as Torah Jews to be able to take the physical and elevate it to the spiritual, to be able to have the correct mindset that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives everyone exactly what they need when they need it. And we are held accountable for every single thing that we do. Hashem rewards and punishes measure for measure. And realize that not only in that realm is there this responsibility, but everything we do impacts the entire world around us. Now we can go out and change the world.